Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
As we continue our mission to find the dynasties of professional football history, author Mike Richmond joins us to remind us just how good the Washington Redskins teams under Joe Gibbs were in the 1980s and early 90s. Mike's coming up in just a moment to tell us all about it.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And welcome to another edition of where we go to the Dynasty Quest. We're going to go back and look at some of the great teams in professional football history and try to have an expert tell us a little bit about them so we can make our own determination if they are indeed a dynasty or a darn good football team. And I think all these teams we've been talking about are darn good football teams, definitely. And we'll see if they meet the criteria. Tonight, we are going to talk about the Washington franchise. And you know, some great teams have come out of there. But one particular era we're going to talk about is the what we call the Joe Gibbs era. And we have an expert on a subject. His name is Mike Richmond. You can find his website at MikeRichmondJournalist.com, where he has all kinds of information on the Redskins, including his four books that he's written on the subject, the Redskins Encyclopedia, the Washington Redskins Football Vault, Joe Gibbs, An Enduring Legacy, and his newest one, which is out very soon, George Allen, A Football Life. Mike Richmond, welcome to the Pigpen.
Hi, Darren. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Yeah.
I'm very excited to be here.
Well, Mike, we are excited to have you because, you know, we love talking about professional football. And you and I, we met down at the PFRA convention this past summer down in Pittsburgh, and you were nice enough to tell me a little bit about your some of your writings that you had going on and one book that's coming out right now. And, you know, we're going to have a special episode on that here. I believe in a few weeks, we'll let people in on that more, but we'll probably be touching on some of the subject matter. But why don't you tell us a little bit about your background that got you the point of writing four books on the Washington franchise?
Sure. Well, I'm pretty certain that this all started in my youth, and it was a time when, around 10 years old, that's when George Allen came to Washington. It was 1971. And I just became hooked on that team. I mean, I knew a little bit about the Redskins from the 60s, but that era is kind of fuzzy to me. I mean, I don't remember a whole lot. But when Allen came here, he just lit the town on fire. I mean, this is a franchise that hadn't been to the postseason in any capacity since 1945. So he took them to the playoffs for the first time in a quarter century in 1971. And I would just live and die by how well that team did on a Sunday. And I remember I had these huge emotional swings. I'd be the happiest guy if they won. I'd be the saddest guy if they lost. And at the same time, thoughts were crossing my mind about something journalism or writing related or storytelling. And this had been instilled in me by my parents to a large extent. My father got me acclimated to sports, actually playing a lot of sports and, you know, just getting lost in the playground every day, the schoolyard or whatever. And my mother took me to almost every museum you could think of in the Washington area. I'm from Montgomery County, Maryland. So she took me to so many museums in the DC area, and I just became just so immersed in various types of history. And
I think that's like half of the buildings in D.C. are museums, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. She took me to like so many. I don't want to say every museum, but she took me to a lot of museums in the D.C. area, a lot of the Smithsonian museums. The Museum of American History being one. I know we went there a lot. Air and Space and other museums in the D.C. area. We went to so many of them, and I gained a love for history and writing and storytelling at the same time. In the sixth grade, I did a class project called An Amateur Who Played Like a Pro, and it was a bound project in sixth grade. And so I wrote, I think it was about 20 pages long and all handwritten. And it was about this amateur player at Ohio State who starred in the Rose Bowl. Back in those days, the Big Ten actually did play the Pac-10 or whatever it was back then in the Rose Bowl. So this guy played USC in the Rose Bowl and he did really well. So I wrote a story about it. It was all fictional. But so I had the thought at the time of, making that combination of writing and sports. And sure enough, I implemented it later in life. I studied journalism at the University of Maryland. I have a master's degree in journalism as well from American University. And I, just one thing after another, I later on became associated with various journalistic outlets in the DC area. I also hooked on with the Associated Press. I was reporting for them from the mid 90s to the late 90s. And I got to go out to Redskins training camp. And they got to know the team. They took me in. I did work for the Snyder era when he bought the team. I was doing work for them. And at around the same time, so this is like the early 2000s, I landed my first contract with a publisher to write the Redskins Encyclopedia, which was my first book.
Wow. So, your credentials on Washington Redskins, Commanders, the Washington football team, they are off the charts. So we definitely have the right guy here for talking about this subject. I can see that. Now, do you remember, you remember George Allen. Do you have any memories of when Lombardi was the coach of the Redskins for that brief period?
I honestly got it. I have to say, I don't, except what I've read and seen in video and photos. Other than that, I don't remember actually being at any games in 69 when he was the coach here. But the following year, 1970, I vividly remember being at a Redskins game. My father took me to a Redskins game at RFK Stadium. The Redskins beat the Cincinnati Bengals that day 20-0. I remember being at that game. I'm sure he took me to games in the 60s as well. I just can't make the connection in terms of actually remembering something visible on the field at the time. But those were the big exciting days of Sonny Jurgensen. I mean, he was lighting the sky in terms of his passes. I mean, and he had some amazing, an amazing receiver core as well. Charlie Taylor, Jerry Smith, and Bobby Mitchell in those days. And but they just weren't winning consistently. I mean, they were at best a 500 team in 1966, which was the year, by the way, given the game we saw the other day with Denver and the Miami Dolphins, Miami winning 70-20. That 66 game when the Redskins beat the Giants 72-41, that was the last regular season game in NFL history when a team scored 70 points. That was in 1966.
Wow. So 50 some years ago, 55 years ago or so.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing. Wow. That's incredible. So history is being made as we speak here. So that's great. Right. Okay. So the reason I said that is I always try to imagine, you have somebody like Lombardi and all of a sudden, he says, "Hey, I'm no longer with the team. I've taken to all these championships and I'm coming to your town." And I just can't imagine. I guess it'd be a comparison like today would be if Bill Belichick just said, "Hey, I'm done with the Patriots and I'm going to go to, some franchise that's been struggling. I'm going to go to the Houston Texans or something like that." And what their fan base, the excitement that would generate when you have a legend coming in. So,
well, from what I've read in the newspaper media coverage at the time, which was nowhere near what it is today, but still, when Lombardi came to the nation's capital, and in I guess it was February of 1969 when he had his first press conference, it was like, Moses parting the Red Sea. I mean, it was a big deal. I mean, you had a godlike figure coming here to coach the Redskins, a legend. And so, he attracted a lot of media for its day at the hotel where that press conference was held. And even Lombardi joked, he tried to temper expectations or enthusiasm. He said, "Oh, it's not really true that I can walk across the Potomac, even when it's frozen."
but he was
a legend back then too. And in fact, that season they finished 7-5-2 was their first winning season since 1955.
Wow, amazing. But we're going to be talking tonight about a coach that came a few coaching staffs after those gentlemen, George Allen and Vince Lombardi. And that's the sort of the Joe Gibbs era, sort of that the glory days of Redskins fandom, I would assume, because you had some championships in there. You had some great teams, a plethora of outstanding quarterbacks and running backs and defenders that just galore some of these great players. And we want to take a look at that era and try to get some information to determine in our minds, is this one of the great dynasties of NFL history? So maybe you could help shed some light on that era for us.
Sure, absolutely, yes. I mean, definitely that Gibbs era is one of the greatest for an individual team in NFL history. If we're going to define it as a dynasty, you could very well make that point. Having won three Super Bowls, I mean, that's the biggest case I think you can make for that team, along with the fact that they had one of the top winning percentages in the NFL. If I'm correct, the 49ers, during the 12-year period that Gibbs was a coacher, I think the 49ers topped them in winning percentage during that period. He was here from 1981 through 1992. So I believe the 49ers did top them in winning percentage, but they were number two. They were up there. And so based on those two facts, you could make definitely be a valid argument to say that they were a dynasty at the time. Here's my personal take on that team. And I have a really, strong inside look on what happened. Two of their Super Bowl wins came in strike-shortened seasons. Their first Super Bowl win was in the 1982 season, Super Bowl 17. And their second one was in Super Bowl, it was in the 87 season. They won Super Bowl 22. Both of them were strike shortened seasons. So you can make all kinds of, judgments about what may have happened if those were true seasons. Did any teams give up in 82 because they hadn't played in 57 days? And so when they returned to play, were they in shape, out of shape, whatever? Were they mentally all there at the time? So, I mean, did they have the same desire at that point in the season to excel as they did at the beginning of the season? So you could make that, that type of discussion about the 82 season. The 87 season, you had the replacements. The Redskins replacements finished 3-0 that year, and they maintained for that team when the regulars came back after the strike. The Redskins maintained first place in the NFC East. What if the replacements had gone 0-3? Okay.
Right.
What would have happened to that team? Would they have been able to still climb out of that and win the NFC East, or have even gone to the playoffs based on that? So you have to take all those variables in mind when talking about those two teams. Other diehard Redskins fans, they may disagree with me, or and then they say that those were two great teams. And in the end, the very end, they absolutely were. But you have to look at the entire stretch of the season to really, gauge what may have really happened during those two periods. Okay. I know you, as a football enthusiast and historian, you can see where I'm coming from.
Yeah, most definitely. Now, the thing is, there's a couple elements that are really interesting in looking at these Redskins teams. First of all, really we're looking at from the first Super Bowl to the third Super Bowl. Was that 1982 season to the 1991 season, if I'm correct?
Right, 1991 season, which was actually, that was a legitimate full season. That was I believe was by far the best of the three Redskin team that won Super Bowls. That team finished 14-2 in the regular season, and then just blew out everybody in the playoffs. No team was within breathing distance of the Redskins in their three playoff games that year, including the Super Bowl. I mean, Buffalo just got destroyed.
Yeah, and they also had a fourth Super Bowl appearance in there. That was the one that they played the Marcus Allen Raiders. Right. That Marcus Allen had that tremendous day and sort of, deflated the balloon of Washington that day. But hey, that happens. But four appearances in was an 11 or 12 year period.
12 years,
and that's pretty outstanding. The thing that they did is they had sort of the 49ers, like we talked about, had their Super Bowls in between some of those Super Bowls. Weren't they mostly sandwiched in between? I think they had 1980, and then they had their
first,
big run.
First they had 80, 81, then 84, then 88.
And you had the 85 Bears and the 86 right. Giants in there. So it's just a very crowded NFC of with some great teams winning Super Bowls in that decade.
Those are some really, really good teams. I mean, you could make the argument if that Bears team had kept their heads on straight after the 85 season and they weren't doing the Super Bowl shuffle or whatever the dance was that they created, the video, and if they had stayed focused on football – you don't know. I mean, they could have been, won two or three more Super Bowls. I don't know. But that team, I think, could have been a lot better. It was the Redskins that beat them in the season, in the playoffs in the two ensuing seasons after they won the 85 Super Bowl.
Oh, okay.
The Redskins beat them in the postseason both years.
Redskins were knocked them out.
86 and 87, yeah.
Okay, interesting. The other element is usually when you're talking about these championship teams, we know the 49ers in the 80s, they're basically, Joe Montana was sort of their core at quarterback. We know Steve Young came in near the end there. Generally there's a core of players that are the same, but the Redskins, not so much. Their core sort of evolved, which makes them even more interesting and intriguing because, Joe Gibbs did it with three different quarterbacks winning those three Super Bowls.
Well, that's the thing about Joe Gibbs. I mean, definitely his winning percentage and the fact that he finished 16-5 in the postseason. I mean, those are marks that are hard to match or exceed. But the fact that he won three Super Bowls with three different quarterbacks, none of whom will ever get in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. I mean, that is extraordinary. Joe Theismann was the best of the three. It was Theismann, Doug Williams, and Mark Rippon.
You don't think Theismann has a shot at the Hall of Fame someday?
I don't think he'll ever get in.
No?
I mean, he's been a preliminary nominee, but his greatest seasons were too short a period of time. He really didn't come on until like the late 70s, and then, which was when Jack Pardee coached the team. And then he took off when Joe Gibbs came here in 81. That's when he really started putting up his greatest numbers. So from 81, basically, through 84, 81, 82, for those four seasons, 81, 82, 83, 84, he was probably among the best, if not an elite quarterback in the NFL. 85, his game was starting to dip. And that was the year that he had the ankle injury. So he really wasn't among the best quarterbacks in the league for the long period of time that you would really need, the extended period of time you would really need one of those quarterbacks to be considered for selection to the Pro Football Hall of Fame, in my opinion.
Yeah, and so the other two quarterbacks, like you said, were Doug Williams and Mark Rippon, right?
Doug Williams, a refugee from the United States Football League, who Gibbs had actually initially was instrumental in drafting him in Tampa Bay in 1979. I believe that was Williams' rookie season. Gibbs was an assistant coach in Tampa at the time. And then Gibbs went to coach with Eric Coryell in San Diego. That's how Gibbs hooked on over there. But Gibbs initially was instrumental in drafting Williams out of Grambling. I think it could have been 78, if not 79. It was one of those two seasons when Gibbs was an assistant there. But Gibbs originally found him. So when Williams was a refugee from the USFL, Gibbs re-signed him again with the Redskins in 1986. And that year, Williams was a backup to Jay Schrader. Then the following year, when Schrader became he was injured in the season opener and Williams came in. And then they played musical chairs for basically the rest of the season. And then Williams came in the postseason that year. And that's when Gibbs named him the starter. But in the after the regular season finale against Minnesota, Williams came in at halftime that game. And then Williams named him the starter for the playoffs after that.
Yeah, I mean, we forget, I think how good Doug Williams was really a good quarterback. I mean, the guy had a rocket arm. I think he gets sort of a bad rap being associated with Tampa Bay. I mean, even though Tampa Bay, I think his first year, that's when they had that really good season. I mean, they had a couple really poor seasons their first couple of years when they came in the league. But I think that's sort of when they made their turnaround, I think, is when
Williams
was there.
They went to the NFC Championship game, I think. Didn't they lose to the Rams that year?
Yeah,
They lost like 9-0 to the Rams that year. The Rams, of course, then lost to the Steelers in the Super Bowl. But yeah, they had a very good season that year. And Williams, well, I would never, consider him in the conversation though for greatest quarterbacks of all time or anything like
No,
that.
I'm not saying that, but I think that he just gets lost in our memories, and maybe some of us that watched him, we associate him with Tampa Bay. I think maybe that's what it is. But and he sort of just had that one really good year that comes to mind. You think with Washington, he might have had some other good years in there too, like you said. But that's me not being a Washington fan. That's what resonates with me going back, 40, 50 years ago and trying to think of these things. But, I was a teenager. What do I know? But from back then.
But he, let's see. So and then Gibbs named him the bona fide starter after Super Bowl 22. But Williams just couldn't. I mean, he didn't rise to the occasion. I mean, he had an opportunity. He started for a lot of the 88 season and a few games in 89. But Gibbs just cut him after that. I don't think he played after in Washington after the 89 season. So, but he had an opportunity. Gibbs named him the true starter heading into the 88 season. So. Gibbs
Yeah.
rewarded him for his performance in Super Bowl 22.
Nice. Now, why don't you remind us about who Mark Rypien was and how he came into the fold of Washington?
Sure. Rypien was a rookie in 1986. That's when he was first drafted. And then he didn't start or gain any considerable playing time until the 88 season. That's when he first got on the field. And that's when he started rotating a little bit with Williams. And then 89, Rypien started more and more games while Williams started a few. And then 90, Rypien was the bona fide starter for most of the 90 season. And then 91 was when everything came together. But
Okay.
Rypien really started coming to his own in like 90, I'd say, because the Redskins, they had a pretty good team. They went 10-6 that year. They beat the Eagles in the opening round of the playoffs that year, and that's when Buddy Ryan got fired.
Okay.
He got fired after that, like a few days after that loss to the Redskins in the opening round of the playoffs. I remember that game distinctly because I lived in Philadelphia at the time. I just remember that a few people saying to me, "Oh, you're a Redskins fan. You got our coach fired."
But you sit there and I'm just making me think of it. Washington really had some great quarterbacks for like those 2 or 3 decades. When you're going from Jurgensen and Kilmer and Theismann to Doug Williams and Schrader, and Schrader was, I thought, was a pretty decent quarterback too when
He threw
he
for
put
4,000 yards in
yeah
1986.
and then Rypien and just all these things. But the one sort of key, at least in the latter part in the 80s, was Joe Gibbs. So he was has to be quite the quarterback whisperer.
He had a great eye for offensive talent and his staff did too. He also had Bobby Bethard, the premier NFL general manager of that time, I would say. He was making a lot of the personnel calls. He and Gibbs were they had a great triumvirate in Jack Kent Cooke, the owner, who ceded authority. I mean, gave a full authority to those guys make decisions. He didn't micromanage from nothing that I remember being reported on him micromanaging. I didn't hear anything about that. And then Gibbs and Bethard were a tremendous brain trust. I mean, they really made amazing decisions in the personnel department. I mean, that first of all, Gibbs inherited some really good players from the previous coaching regimes. He got some great players from Allen, John Riggins being one, Joe Theismann, Mark Mosley, all of whom were instrumental in the 82 Super Bowl winning season. And Mark Murphy, defensive back as well. He was great that year. Joe Lavender was a safety. Gibbs inherited some really good players from Allen. He also got some great ones from Jack Pardee, his immediate predecessor. That 79 draft brought in Art Monk.
Oh,
And they
yeah.
signed Neil Okwuch as a free agent linebacker. Monte Coleman, linebacker, who later played like 16 years for the team. They drafted him that year too. Don Warren, tight end. All of those guys were, had their fingerprints on the glory run through the Gibbs era.
We'll be back with more from this interview in just a moment, right after this.
If you have ever seen a sports story on TV or online or maybe in a newspaper, chances are once upon a time you have seen it before. Hello, I'm Dana Augusta, former sports writer and now podcaster, and I host a show called Historically Speaking Sports, where we place a historical spin on a current sports headline or take the topic that most people are talking about and compare and contrast it through the lens of sports history. In this show, we talk to researchers, authors, and other sports history connoisseurs about what fans and analysts are talking about, yet in the terms of sports history. We also do a weekly top five countdown, highlighting moments that pertain to the subject of the show or the five greatest moments in the history of sports that took place that week. And to complete the show, we send a shout out to a famous sports figure or moment in sports history that both pertains to that episode or someone who had a dramatic role in sports history or an event in history that fans just need to be reminded of. The show, Historically Speaking Sports, where we put a historical spin on sports headlines. That's Historically Speaking Sports, right here on the Sports History Network.
This is Greg Tranter, co-author of The Buffalo Bills, an illustrated timeline of a storied team book. And you are listening to the Pigskin Dispatch podcast.
And now back to the interesting conversation with our guest. This era that we're talking about, you know, this 12-year period. So Monty Coleman was sort of in there that whole time. But Darryl Green, you know, the majority of that time too?
For the majority, yeah. He was drafted in 83. So okay. That was Gibbs' third season. And he stayed with Gibbs, of course, through the end of the 92 season. And then beyond, Green didn't retire until after the 2002 season. So he played 20 years in Washington.
Okay, was there any other players in there? We know the quarterback sort of was a roulette wheel of quarterbacks going through that 1980s era. But how about any of the other players besides Coleman and Green that were sort of, they're the majority of this run?
Jacoby, the Hogs.
All the Hogs.
Well, except for Mark May, Raleigh McKenzie. He wasn't there the whole time. Mark May wasn't there. Jim Lachey wasn't there the whole time. But the initial core of Hogs,
Russ
Jacoby, Graham Bostic, they were there the whole time.
Okay.
Yeah, wow. They were there for the entirety of the Gibbs run.
Wow, that's outstanding for an offensive lineman to have the longevity of that. That's tremendous.
That was amazing. Mark May was not there the whole time. Who else? Dean was not there the whole time. George Stark was not there the whole time. Stark was a holdover. He was another holdover from the Allen years. He was originally acquired by George Allen. So, but Stark was there for the first Super Bowl, as was Fred Dean and Mark May. So all of those guys that they put in place as the Hogs in 81, Gibbs' first season, and the Hogs named that way by Joe Bugel, the offensive line coach, they were there for the first Super Bowl, the first Super Bowl team, 82.
Okay, interesting.
And possibly 87, Super Bowl 22 as well. I believe all of those guys were still in play, except for Stark. Stark wasn't there for the Super Bowl 22 team.
Okay.
And Dean wasn't there either.
All right. And now another, you know, fixture of the offense, you already mentioned John Riggins, who, you know, great running back in the earlier part of that run. Who are some of the other running backs besides Riggins? And maybe even talk a little about Riggins a little bit for listeners to help us remember what a great back he was.
Yeah, well, Riggins was first acquired by George Allen in 1976. For whatever reason, that year, it was an unfettered year in terms of free agency. It was just that one single season, 1976. So George Allen, being George Allen, he went to school in free agency. He got Riggins, Gene Fugit, Cowboys tight end, and Calvin Hill, who came out of the World Football League but had previously played for the Cowboys. And he got Pat Sullivan, too, who I never played. But those previous three that I mentioned did have an impact on the Redskins in 76, and they went to the playoffs that year. But Riggins stayed on through the Pardee era and then Gibbs, and he made such an amazing impact in 82. I mean, he demanded to carry the ball in the 82 postseason, which was because of the strike that year. The Redskins had four playoff games before the Super Bowl. Riggins gained, like, including the Super Bowl, he gained like 600 plus yards through that whole that whole period in the Super Bowl, 166 yards. He was named the MVP of the game. He ran on the most famous play in Redskins history, the 43-yard run on fourth down. It was a fourth and one call in the fourth quarter. The Redskins were trailing at the time 17-13. He ran the ball on that play for a touchdown, 43-yard touchdown. Redskins went up 20-17 and never looked back. They won the game 27-17. But Riggins was an interesting pickup by George Allen. I mean, he was still at the time, he was a very eccentric figure. You know, the hairstyling, the mohawk, and just he was his own person, beat to his own drum even at that time. And you would think that it would be totally antithetical to George Allen. I mean, who was like a straight-laced as you come, but George Allen signed him. And so then, yeah, Riggins was Riggins in the ensuing years, too. He, even under Gibbs, he didn't say crazy things. You know, he held out the 1980 season, which was Pardee's last year. He held out. He thought that after the Redskins lost the season-ending game in 79 to the Cowboys and they were eliminated from the playoffs, that he didn't want to come back anymore. So he sat out 80. He came back in 81 when Gibbs came back. And as the story goes, Gibbs influenced him to come back. Gibbs went out to his house in Kansas to, or his ranch in Kansas to talk to him and influenced him to come back. And then when Riggins came back, he told the press, quote, "I'm bored, I'm broken, I'm back." And he came back and he had a great year in 81. That's when Gibbs implemented the single back offense, single back two tight end offense, which as the belief goes and you know, the video will show this as well, that he learned that from Coryell in San Diego. But he modified it when he got here to Washington. And yeah, the single back with Riggins. See, Joe Washington had gotten hurt in the preseason. Joe Washington was going to be the back, or they were going to either team in the backfield or Joe Washington was going to be the featured back. But Riggins took over. Joe Washington got hurt in the preseason that year. So Joe Washington, you know, the great running, really good running back from the Colts. The Redskins had acquired him. So he got hurt. So Riggins took over as a single back. And so that's when it really took off that year. And then 82, the Redskins finished 8-8 in 81. They won 8 of their last 11 games. In 82 is when and I'm sorry, I have my years mixed up. Washington got injured in the 82 preseason, Joe Washington. So Riggins became the featured back in 82. I had my season mixed up. They both, Joe Washington and Riggins, were there in 81. But Washington got injured in the 82 preseason, and then Riggins became the featured back in 82. And then in the playoffs, that's when he demanded to carry the ball in that extended playoff stretch.
Okay. So yeah, the diesel, I can remember that playoff run. He was quite the man with the ball in those games. Diesel, that's for sure. That's for sure. Okay, so who was sort of after Riggins had his run, who was sort of the next feature back that came up through the Redskins?
They acquired George Rogers, I believe, in 85. Riggins was there through 85. I think he retired after the 85 season, but they had acquired George Rogers in 85. He got a lot of carries that year. And there were other guys that they drafted. Trying to think. Well, later on during the Super Bowl run, it was a guy named Ricky Irvins they drafted. Oh, they another guy they acquired later on was Ernest Byner. The guy that did
from
the
Browns. Yeah,
fumble in the AFC Championship game, 87.
Right.
The Redskins later got him, and he scored a touchdown in Super Bowl 26. I remember asking him during an interview, I said, so do you think scoring that touchdown in Super Bowl 26 was redemption for the fumble? He said, no, not really. Not really. he didn't look at it that way. But, I mean, it was an amazing, memorable moment for him, having scored a touchdown in that Super Bowl. I also asked him about how Marty Schottenheimer reacted when Byner was walking off the field after he fumbled the ball in that AFC Championship game. He said Schottenheimer was great about it. You know, no, there was no yelling or anything like that. And, I mean, I don't think anybody put him down in any way.
Yeah, so it's a shame because he was such a good back, even his career at Cleveland, you know, but that's what everybody remembers is something bad happens. You know, Wade Boggs, you remember for him ruining the Red Sox chances of winning the World Series at that time. And just, you know, one bad instance and it sort of you know, rottens the whole barrel of apples for that player. And that's a shame that that has to happen. But Beiner was an outstanding back during his
career. Oh, he was. Yeah. Yeah. He had some great totals throughout his career, thousands of rushing yards. He was great. He was also a really good receiving back. He could catch the ball out of the backfield. So, and then later on in his career, after he left the Redskins, didn't he? I think he played for the Baltimore Ravens too. He was still with the Ravens.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Yeah. I'm a Steelers fan. So all this is painful. Remembering him with the Browns and the Ravens. So I got to see him up close and personal.
But he had some great career longevity. Yeah. He was a really, really good runner.
Especially for the style of runner he is, you know, like Riggins too, you know, they were just bruising backs, and to have that long of a career is amazing. So tells that what a great athlete they were.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Shape. So, wow. Excellent. So tell us a little bit about the defense, you know, during this run, who are some of the standouts on defense?
Dexter Manley would be one of them. Well, first of all, going back to the 81 draft, which was arguably the greatest draft in Redskins history, they acquired Dexter Manley, Darryl Grant, who had the interception in the NFC Championship game in 82 that punched their ticket to Super Bowl 17. Those two were really good defense players. Manley had 96 sacks in his career. Darryl Grant was a really good player. Charles Mann was another really good defensive lineman that they acquired in the 83 draft. I should say Manley was a defensive end. Darryl Grant was a defensive tackle. And then Charles Mann was another really good defensive end that they acquired in the 83 draft. He had 50-plus sacks in his career. So he was very good. And Neil Okowitz, the linebacker I referred to earlier, middle linebacker, they signed him as a free agent in 79. Monty Coleman, Darryl Green, Mark Murphy. Dusick was there the early part. Rich Mallott, Mel Kaufman, really other, you know, very solid linebackers. They were there as well. So they had some, I would say, they had a strong defense. I wouldn't say in any year under Gibbs, I don't think it was one of the best defenses in the league. But Richie Pettibone was the defensive mind at the time. He was on staff, I believe, under Pardee, and then Gibbs kept him on, and he became the defensive coordinator. And so he had these really imaginative defenses through the 80s and early 90s. And you know, the players really liked him too. And so the defense was really, really crucial to a lot of the Redskins' wins throughout that era. Gibbs himself was an offensive-minded coach. Everybody knew that. I mean, he focused mostly on the offense. It was like two different head coaches almost. But Pettibone was a really good defensive mind.
Okay. Now, during run championship runs and these great teams, you know, we look back and you know, there's some key moments to them. You know, you think of like the catch when you think about the 49ers, that's probably one of the first plays. You might think about the immaculate reception for the Steelers run in the 70s. What were some of those moments or moment of those Redskins teams in that Joe Gibbs era that people would remember to, you know, there were the sort of nice key elements took them to championship, or at least ones that are so fond in our memory that.
Sure. Well, one of the first one that sticks out in my mind is, you know, has to be Riggins run of Super Bowl 17. I mean, that was such an iconic moment in NFL, not only Redskins history, but NFL history. I mean, NFL films caught him as he was running toward the end zone. The cameraman was looking directly at him. That's when you see the facial expressions on the part of Riggins, the grimace on his face and the determination to make it to the end zone. So NFL films caught him doing that. That's such an iconic moment, like I said, in not only Redskins, but NFL history. Darryl Green chasing down Tony Dorsett in the 1983 Monday night game between the two teams, the season opener. Dorsett, even at that point in his career, he was in the latter stages. He was still a very fast running back. Green came out of nowhere to run him down. Like Dorsett had already run like 70 yards or something on that play. Green chased him down, knocked him out of bounds, like around the 5-yard line. But that's when Green, for people really took notice of, who is this guy, Darryl Green? Sure enough, yeah. He was this guy that they found out of itty bitty Texas A&I, you know. Beathard found him. So just plucked him out. He was a first round draft pick in 83. And interestingly, and I actually interviewed Beathard about this several years ago. I asked, well, what would have happened if the Dolphins hadn't taken Dan Marino with the 27th pick? And he said the Redskins would have taken Marino with the 28th. Well, as history goes, the Dolphins did take Dan Marino and the Redskins took Darryl Green. So either way, they would have gotten a Hall of Famer.
Yeah, most definitely. Interesting.
So those are two iconic moments. Certainly the, you know, Lawrence Taylor's tackle of Joe Theismann in the Monday night game, the just, you know, cringeworthy sight of Theismann, his leg being crunched in that play. I mean, that is an iconic shot in itself. That everybody remembers that. That ended Theismann's career. He did try to make a comeback in 86, but he wasn't able to do it. He even told me one leg was shorter than the other. So he couldn't make the comeback.
You know, I don't know if you were reminded of that, but week two of this current season, when the Steelers and the Browns played and Minka Fitzpatrick hit Nick Chubb, and when they said the network didn't want to show the replay from the angle of the hit. And it took me back, and I sort of appreciated it because I remember that day in 1986 or whenever it was when it happened on that Monday night game. It was a Monday night game, I believe, too, wasn't it? Monday Night Football?
I believe so, yes.
Where, you know, ABC did show that, and it sort of stuck in your memory. And, you know, it was the water cooler talk the next day. I'm like, oh, my God, you know, legs aren't supposed to look like that when they get hit. You know, it was horrible. So I'm kind of glad that the network decided not to show that replay from that angle.
Well, interestingly, it was a single ligament tear, from what I understand. It wasn't as serious, I guess, as everybody first thought. You know, people were saying his career may be over, but who knows? He could make a comeback now. But, I mean, you can look at it both ways. I mean, some people, they want to see that stuff. They want to see those plays or those sites or whatever. Other people, like yourself, I mean, you don't want to see it. So, I mean, I fully respect that. I didn't care one way or another about seeing that particular play. Every time I see the Theismann injury, though, it's hard to watch. Yeah, he was sandwiched. He had Lawrence Taylor on top of him, and I believe Harry Carson toward the bottom. He was just sandwiched on that play. And even Lawrence Taylor is, you know, as fierce a player as he was, and he was signaling for the guys on the sidelines, the doctors and whoever, to come back out, to come onto the field. The trainers, the training team, to come onto the field and you know, help Theismann out. I mean, he was in really bad shape.
Yeah, that was horrific. Huh. Yeah, I don't need to remember that one. That's a particular play. That was a bad one.
Then, of course, Doug Williams' performance in Super Bowl 22. I mean, his four touchdown performance in the second quarter of that game, and then the end result being a 42-10 Redskins win over the Denver Broncos that game. So, and Williams had the game of his life. I mean, that's what made him legendary in the minds of so many. You know, having won a Super Bowl like that, being the first black starting quarterback in a Super Bowl, and throwing four touchdown passes in the second quarter. I mean, everything just opened up for him that game. And the Redskins were also on the line. They were so much bigger than the Denver Broncos. And even the Broncos said it before. I remember interviewing one of the Broncos defensive backs about that game. And he said, you know, we saw some of those Redskins hogs, those Redskins offensive linemen. We said, my God, we have nobody even close to that size.
Yeah,
so they were huge.
Bunch. Yeah, big bunch, that's for sure. Yeah. So, now, Mike, you have, you know, so you reminded us of so many great players and moments in Redskins history back in that period of the 80s, basically. Now, do you have, we mentioned at the beginning that you have a website and you have four books out on the Redskins. And where maybe you could at least tell us a couple of the books that would have some of this era of Redskins history that people could get to read up on this and to enjoy the history further. Maybe you could share with us your website again and the books that they should go after.
Sure, Darren. I'm happy to do that. My website is MikeRichmanJournalist.com, And Richman is R-I-C-H-M-A-N, MikeRichmanJournalist.com. And to go to the books page in particular, you put a forward slash at the end of books. So MikeRichmanJournalist.com/books. And all of my books are featured on the website. My first book, The Redskins Encyclopedia, came out in 2007. Then I followed up 3 years later with the Washington Redskins Football Vault. And then in 2015, my book was published, Joe Gibbs, An Enduring Legacy. And as we speak, my latest book, George Allen Football Life, has hit the shelves. So the Redskins Encyclopedia is a compilation of the team's history from its inception in 1932 all the way through the 2006 season, so 75 years of Redskins history. The Redskins Vault is it's a very heavy memorabilia book. There's replicas of press passes, game program covers, ticket stubs. They're all throughout the book, and I wrote the text for the book. The memorabilia really makes that book special. The book Joe Gibbs, An Enduring Legacy, which was published by his foundation, Youth for Tomorrow, that is, it's basically formatted on the four pillars of Gibbs' life. Those are the four chapters. His Redskins coaching career, his NASCAR experiences, which he's still involved in, NASCAR ownership, his involvement with Youth for Tomorrow, which he founded in the 1980s and still runs to this day, and which is a wonderful home here in near where I live in Virginia, that houses kids, teenagers that have been involved in sex trafficking, victims of sex trafficking, drug addiction, run-ins with the law, things like that. And then my latest book, George Allen, Football Life, is a full-fledged biography on the legendary NFL coach, the third winningest coach in NFL history in terms of percentage. He's 7-12. John Madden is first. Vince Lombardi is number two, and then comes George Allen for coaches with at least 100 career victories. So I wrote a full biography on George Allen, and like I said earlier, I grew up with the George Allen Redskins. That was my team when George Allen came here in 71. I was 10 and I just became hooked. So I felt it was my obligation to write about George Allen, and his life really hasn't been researched that much. And when I undertook the project, I mean, there was no authoritative biography on George Allen. So I was happy to take on that role.
Oh, we're looking forward to getting a copy of that one and some of these other ones too. And folks, if you are driving a car or you're riding your bike or whatever, listen to this podcast, we will have a link to Mike's website to get you there when you're done with your driving, when you're safe and can order a copy of the books. Get all four of them. You can get, I think, all four of them on your site too. Right?
Three of them are available: the Redskins Encyclopedia, the Redskins Vault, and George Allen Football Life. The Washington Redskins Football Vault was so popular in the year, close to 2 years that it was out. I mean, it sold out on the first printing. So it was a very, very popular book. I wouldn't call it unique, because the Buffalo Bills have a similar book as well, a memorabilia book like that. But those are the only two NFL teams that I know of that have that type of book. There are college basketball and football programs that have that, but the Redskins and the Buffalo Bills are the only two teams that have that.
Very nice. Well, Mike, we really appreciate you sharing this great historic era of football, of professional football, and for your team, the Washington Redskins, Washington franchise, and talking about these great, Coach Joe Gibbs and some of the other coaches that we've sort of circumvented but talked a little bit about. We're going to talk a little bit more about George Allen here in a coming episode once we get into that book a little bit. We'll dive into that. So we'd love to have you on again to do that. And we really thank you for your time and helping us understand and remember these great Washington teams from that era.
Well, thank you very much, Darren. I really enjoyed being on with you, and I know you're a great pro football historian yourself, and the questions were perfect. And so thank you very much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. we invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, is found right here on the Sports History Network.